This is Audible.
A PDF enhancement accompanies this program. Simon & Schuster Audio presents Voice Lessons for Parents: What to Say, How to Say It, and When to Listen by Wendy Mogul, PhD. Read by the author.
To Ann and Leonard Mogul. It was as though she had stepped into a boat and was swept off by a strong current. She did not know what all the words meant, and she could not pronounce a good many of the names, but nobody interrupted to correct her, and she read on and on, steadied by the strongly marked rhythm, drawn forward swiftly from one clanging, sonorous rhyme to another. Dorothy Canfield Fisher, from Understood Betsy, 1916. Author's note. When I was a psychology student in the 1970s, some awful fictions were sold as fact. Schizophrenia was caused by schizophrenogenic, overprotective yet rejecting mothers. Autism by refrigerator mothers. Male homosexuality by weak dads, helpless to control their overbearing wives. During the same era, the women's movement aimed to banish the concept of biology as destiny. Girls and boys came into the world as equals. What mattered was nurture. Provide girls with blocks and boys with dolls, and the differences would evaporate. While well-intentioned, this approach to protecting rights and allowing for growth and unlimited opportunity was too narrow and didn't withstand scientific scrutiny. Yet the 70s also yielded some awesome truths that hold today. One was the theory of psychological androgyny developed by social psychologist Sandra Bem. Her robust research revealed that girls who exhibited some traits traditionally considered masculine and boys who displayed some that were considered feminine were emotionally healthier than children whose range of attitudes and behaviors fell at the extremes of gender norms. Bem found that narrowly defined, restrictive gender roles had a negative effect on individuals and on society as a whole. Bem began a movement that shifted from fixed definitions of gender expression to today's more nuanced understanding of the rich and complex variations of human identity and sexuality. In the late 1980s, I had an experience that helped me deepen my insight into this topic. The parents of 4.5-year-old Ash came to see me about their son's perplexing behavior. His mom said, "At least once a day, Ash suddenly turns his head and looks upward with a concerned expression on his face. Then he lifts his arms, bends both elbows, scrunches up his fists, and dashes across the room on his toes." I asked him why he was doing this, and he explained in a matter-of-fact tone, "When Cinderella sees the clock is about to chime midnight, she has to gather up the skirts of her ball gown so she can fly over to the pumpkin coach really, really fast." Dr. Mogul, we're worried he's suffering from gender identity disorder. At that time, GID was considered a mental disorder and was much in the news. To determine an appropriate diagnosis and treatment plan, I consulted with two senior psychiatrist colleagues who specialized in working with young boys who had this condition. One held a philosophy of rigid rules akin to those employed by gay conversion therapists of today. Tell those parents to immediately purge the boys' room of any dolls and feminine costumes, not to permit any playdates with girls, and that dad has to start playing sports with him every day. They should also enroll him in at least one peewee team. The other colleague said, tell the parents to let him be, to celebrate his imagination and even join in the fun. Mom might ask, do the seats in a pumpkin coach have cushions or are they more like benches? When I met with Ash's parents, I told them not to worry about his present behavior or forecast his future. All we know now is that sometimes he's Cinderella and we love him, and that your respect for his creativity and self-expression is vital for his growth. The 90s brought advanced technological tools in neuroscience, providing a flood of data about gender differences in rates of cognitive, emotional, and physical development, sensory perceptions like hearing and sight, anatomy and brain architecture, the effect of hormones on emotions, and other attributes that are subtle but significant when communicating with children and teenagers. We don't yet have a substantial body of research on whether transgendered people have brains more similar to their experienced gender than to their assigned gender, the one checked off on the box on their birth certificate, but the work has begun. Today, most mental health professionals understand that gender falls on a spectrum rather than into neat binary categories, and that each person's experience of who they are, how they want to dress, what name they prefer to be called, and who they are drawn to for companionship, romance, and sexual involvement don't fit into predetermined or fixed classifications. With technology and social media, parents must be lifelong learners in order to make and enforce sensible and protective rules for their children. The same is true of understanding gender expression. If you want your child to see you as a trusted traveler, you have to do your homework. I know of no better starting place than the website genderspectrum.org. It's a jargon-free, non-polemical, sober, and thorough resource for educators, parents, and teenagers. In listening to the Voice Lessons chapters about boys and girls and my statements about attitudes and behaviors of mothers and fathers, please insert mental quotation marks as needed around the references to gender differences. The same applies if you are a single parent, a same-sex couple, or belong to any of the new family configurations that now coexist alongside the more traditional nuclear family. A sensitive understanding of biological differences provides insight into how we can help girls become the confident and creative scientists, engineers, and mathematicians we'll need in the 21st century, while at the same time protecting them from pressure to be perfect and overly accommodating of others in every aspect of their lives. It allows us to find the best ways to promote the pride and capability of boys in a changing economy and in classrooms where their high energy and delight in finding the funny are too often seen as symptoms of a problem. Boys need adult mentors to raise them to be men who are emotionally expressive, deeply connected to and concerned about others, and capable of regulating their strong impulses. My main goal in voice lessons is to teach you how to learn the dialect needed to converse with your daughters and sons at every stage and in every phase of the child's life. Some lessons are based on the new understanding of neuroscience and biology. some on my decades of clinical practice with all types of families, some on recent and unfolding cultural insights. None are meant to stereotype or generalize. Always, I rely on parents to adapt strategies to suit their own values and the evolving spirit, personality, and needs of their unique child. In order to protect the privacy of the individuals and institutions described in this book, I've changed the names, identifying characteristics, and locations of events as appropriate. Introduction. This is a book for parents who want to find their voice. Some of you are new mothers or fathers, just beginning the lifelong conversation that will redefine you and shape the tiny being you have conjured into the world. Some of you have been parents for a few years or for many. You may be hoarse from saying the same things over and over, whether reminding, pleading, or screaming, and still you aren't heard. Your child forgets to flush the toilet, tells his little sister she's stupid, says he can't fall asleep ever, and dawdles in the morning always. Or despite your nightly appeals or threats, your daughter does her homework while socializing online and speaks to you in a manner so rough and rude your own mother would have grounded you for it. Your words are weightless, but you don't give up. You just lose faith in yourself and lose hope for your child. Some of you are mute. You have given up. You have lost inspiration, confidence, and the energy to keep trying to connect with your child. You've mastered the perfect angle from which to take a selfie with your 14-year-old. But the two of you seem to have nothing in common. So you default to nagging about schoolwork or retreat to the easy companionship of screens or the demands of your job. Hoarse or mute, new parents or seasoned, you wonder if there's a magic formula that will make everything easier, everything better. There's no magic formula. All you have is your voice, but if you know how to use it, your voice is all you need. Voice Lessons for Parents is about talking to children and teenagers and teaching them to express themselves in spoken language. It's about using words and tone, cadence and timing, setting and demeanor to deepen your relationship with your child. It's not a formula, but a practice. Humans are wired to communicate. The baby looks you in the eye, your mirror neurons fire away, she coos and babbles. You instinctively repeat her sounds, gestures, and expressions. Soon the two of you are exchanging words, then sentences. But although it is the most natural of skills, talking to a child requires devotion, forethought, and patience. It involves the serve and return volley of vocalizations, the restraint required for good listening, and a welcoming attitude toward breezy, rib-tickling, gross-out, deep, heartbreaking, heartfelt, awkward but worthy, and illuminating talk. All these conversations enrich family life by building bonds of love and trust, enhancing children's understanding of their own passions and preferences, and helping them to see their parents and other adults as complete people. I've been working with parents and children for more than 3 decades. My focus has been on educating parents about child development, family dynamics, and unrealistic cultural expectations. This understanding helped them relate to their children in a more sensitive and authoritative way. But a few years ago, I began to change my approach. I had always encouraged parents to reenact with me the arguments or impasses they were experiencing with their children. As we drilled down during these sessions, I started noticing how they were saying things as much as what they were saying. These women and men were normally excellent communicators. With other adults, they spoke in strong, clear, direct tones. But when role-playing the fights with their children, I watched an often dramatic transformation. They shrank and froze. They sounded weak, wounded, indignant, exasperated. Some talked in baby voices. Some whispered. All sounded high-pitched and pinched. Their shoulders would hunch up and they'd start jabbing their fingers accusingly. At that point, I would ask, "And then did you start shouting?" Heads bowed. They would nod. I'd say, "How loud? Do it now." They would try. I'd smile. "Wow, she really won that round, huh?" We'd laugh. Sharing this frustration and shame had a dual purpose. It lightened their load and helped them see that even if their words were psychologically spot on, the children weren't listening because of the way the message was being delivered. I decided to flip my usual process with a few clients and begin our work together by coaching them on vocal techniques. I would introduce the concepts of speaking in a lower register and with more warmth, slowing their tempo, and displaying relaxed but confident body language. Then we'd practice, and I would encourage them to use their new skills starting that night. The children's transformations were surprisingly swift. Parents reported that even small changes in their tone and demeanor shifted the entire metabolism of the relationship. When the parents trained themselves to listen attentively and have child-sized conversations with their young sons and daughters, the children cooperated and became more obliging and expansive. The same thing happened when parents learned to find openings for respectful, agenda-free conversations with teenagers. The art of conversation with children rests not only on content, but also on learning to speak in an ever-changing dialect that evolves as the child matures. Nearly any idea can be communicated if the adult's style and form matches the cognitive development, interests, and temperament of the child listener. These factors, along with typical gender differences in how children learn, influence what a boy or girl hears and comprehends. Your 7-year-old son is doomed if you expect him to listen and respond the way his older sister did at that age. But tune into his channel and you'll have an easier time getting through. The lessons in this book are designed to elevate the atmosphere in your home, bring you closer to your child, and act as a counterbalance to our nervous and distracted culture. But to take full advantage of these strategies, there's one more voice you may need to adjust. It's the voice in your head, whispering, "There's not enough. Not enough resources, spots in the best schools, teachers' attention, opportunities, friends who'll provide the right type of influence. Not enough hours in the day, funds in the account, time to save the planet, chances to do things over." Fear of scarcity is alive and blooming inside the minds of most parents. That's what sends their voices into the pinched and panicky zone. Fear is behind rushing, hovering, chiding, and pleading that sours our conversations with our children. For as long as I've practiced therapy with families, parents have been worried about scarcity. Now, as technology pulls us toward a thrilling but unfathomable future, They are even more frightened. The children must cultivate 21st century skills. But what are these? Coding or welding? Robotics or foraging? Fluency in Mandarin or the social and emotional finesse to be both a leader and a team player? Or all of the above? Well-meaning parents swing between frantic overplanning and hopeless paralysis. Meanwhile, their children suffer from anxiety, depression, nightmares, eating disorders, and dwindling motivation. The pace of our world will keep speeding up. Although this feels terrifying, as if you can't do the one thing you're programmed to do, protect your child, it is also liberating. Worry and plan as you might, you can't predict which skills will be rewarded, which degrees will lead to the most fulfilling careers, which jobs will be the most lucrative, or which cities will be safe for your child 20 years from now. The way to protect your child is not by trying to outmaneuver the future. It's by focusing on what is timeless and providing the basics children have always needed. Stability, consistency, tenderness, and acceptance. Relinquish the fear and you open a door to enchantment. One of the great pleasures of being a parent is getting to grow up a second time in another era, led by a small person with a sensibility that is quite different from yours. Children's fresh perspective, playfulness and innocence, their ardent desire to know, adds color to your life. Being a parent can reduce rather than increase your stress if you recognize that it's a chance to explore majestic and mysterious places alongside your son or daughter. No matter how much jeopardy our planet is in, it's still green and watery and full of beauty and magic, and children are filled with wonder. They will lead you on an incredible journey if they trust you, if you take the time, and if you're willing to follow. Chapter 1. The audience is listening. From infancy through toddlerhood. A mother's first words to her newborn are soft and musical, sweet and high. Social scientists call this instinctive language parentese. It used to be known as motherese until researchers noticed that when speaking to babies, men also emphasized keywords, simplify their syntax, and slow their delivery to match the child's attention span and comprehension level. Children as young as 3 spontaneously speak parentese to babies and toddlers. What are the hallmarks of parentese? A lilting cadence with enough variation to draw baby's focus. A raised pitch that is gentle rather than squeaky. Drawn out vowels and clear, exaggerated consonants. A simple but appealing vocabulary with alliteration and repetition. That's a big bubble. It's bedtime for baby. Bedtime for a sweet, sleepy baby. While infants can't understand the meaning of individual words, they are alert to diverse aspects of your presentation. Volume and rhythm, emphasis and repetition, eye contact, facial expressions, and gestures. Perhaps the most important is the constant feedback between parent and child. The baby points and smiles or cries, and the parent describes what the child is seeing. That's a big doggy! A big doggy on our street! As the child learns to form words, the parent offers gentle encouragement using proper pronunciation and expanding on the topic. Twuck! That's right. It's a yellow truck. As early as 1977, Harvard psychologist and linguist Catherine E. Snow wrote that language acquisition is the result of a process of interaction between mother and child, which begins early in infancy, to which the child makes as important a contribution as the mother, and which is crucial to cognitive and emotional development, as well as language acquisition. She was ahead of her time. For two decades, there were no experimental studies to back up her claim. But scientific advances now suggest that brain development is indeed linked to social interaction. Parent ease, baby's bridge to verbal communication, is more than a way to teach language. It helps shape and support a child's ability to think. What to say to a baby. From the first days of life, your baby is learning about tone and rhythm and how sentences are constructed. Enjoy this fleeting phase of parenthood. Take the liberty to indulge in uncensored monologues that would bore, offend, or irk those with more developed comprehension. Soon enough, your toddler will be able to repeat verbatim that which you did not intend to share with other adults. Your child will have the verbal skill to command, "Don't talk! No singing!" At bedtime, your imperious 4-year-old will decree, "No, not that story. I want the one about how I fall into a magical hole and meet two princesses named Mariella and Marietta. And one night they go swimming in the moat and they meet a fish who can speak French. Tell a story exactly like that, but this time it's not a fish and it's not French, okay?" This is what awaits you, but for now, your baby will cheerfully tolerate your aimless thinking out loud. In addition to chatting about your thoughts, feelings, and plans, get in the habit of narrating your baby's daily routines. Pulling a shirt off baby without warning can surprise her. Wiping a tender bottom might sting. Water poured on the head without explanation can startle. Previewing the action helps baby learn trust and acclimates her to her world. Turn off the radio or television when you're talking so she can hear your words easily. Use vivid, simple, but detailed descriptions. "Now I'm going to wash you with this slippery soap. See the bubbles? You can pop them." These pointy spikes on your comb are called teeth. Like teeth in your mouth, all in a row. Don't worry about introducing unfamiliar words. This is how baby expands her vocabulary, and new sounds and combinations of syllables will hold her interest as much as your lively narration. Use words that come prepackaged with sensory delights. "The water splashes when we slap our hands down. This peach is really ripe. The juice squirts out when I bite it. I hear Mittens purring. Do you hear him?" Prepare your baby for specific sensations she will experience. "Our new rug is here. Let's see how it feels to touch it. It's soft and fuzzy. This is your red sweater. Let's put it on so you'll be warm." Orient her to her surroundings. "Listen, do you hear that loud whirring sound? There might be a helicopter in the sky above the house. Let's go see if we can find it." "Now we're going out the door and down the steps. 1, 2, 3. Here's our car in the driveway." Of course, there will be plenty of times when your loving voice will not please or comfort. Don't take it personally if your tired or cranky baby rejects you or ignores your tender tone. Sometimes a good cry is the exercise she needs most. Singing away the baby blues. In every culture, mothers sing lullabies to soothe both their babies and themselves. The songs follow a consistent pattern. Their meter mimics the rocking motion the fetus experienced in the womb, and the melodies are simple, often composed of only 5 notes. The tempo is steady and hypnotic. These attributes align with the newborn's limited ability to process sound and movement. When mother sings, baby feels the familiar vibration of her vocal cords, the rhythmic movement of her breath, and is soothed by the swaying of her body. Lullabies serve a deeper purpose than merely quieting a fussy child. Just as their musical form is consistent across the globe, so is the startling nature of their lyrics. Some are plaintive incantations to hush, go to sleep, but often the words slide into a darker realm of uncertainty, fear, and loneliness. 12 weary months have crept away since he, upon thy natal day, left thee and me to seek afar a bloody fate in doubtful war. Baloo, my boy, lie still and sleep. It grieves me sore to hear thee weep. Lady Anne Bothwell's Lament, Scotland. Hush, little baby, don't you cry. You know your mama was born to die. All My Trials, Bahamas. Lullabies are a weary parent's chance to express raw truths. When dark feelings are transposed into music, the day's buildup of frustration, fear, and resentment is given wings. Instead of hardening into bitterness, it evaporates, refreshing your view of the loveliness of your sleeping child. The healing properties of lullabies have been confirmed by science. Studies of infants in intensive care units show that hearing a lullaby steadies baby's heart rate and breathing, helps them eat and sleep better, and reduces their perception of pain during medical tests. And as baby listens to your lullaby, she's learning to communicate. She takes in your words and facial expressions, and she coos back. She watches your lips and mimics the shapes they make. Babies absorb your song with all of their senses. Blooming and pruning, language and baby's brain. Technology allows us to peek inside the human brain and see how spoken language impacts children's development even before birth. Picture an incubator, its wee inhabitant, a preemie, delivered 8 to 15 weeks early. Inside the incubator, a small speaker plays the sound of mother's voice and heartbeat. 40 incubators are equipped with speakers. 20 preemies receive an extra 3 hours each day of the sounds of mom. After 1 month, researchers use neuroimaging to measure each preemie's auditory cortex, the hearing center of the brain. Those with the extra hours of mom have significantly larger auditory centers in the temporal lobe. Her voice and heartbeat have literally caused the baby's brain to grow larger. The prenatal connection between mother's voice and baby's brain development has been proven in several studies of newborns. 1 day after birth, a newborn will suck on a pacifier faster for the reward of hearing a recording of his own mother's voice. Newborns can discriminate between their parents' language and one that is unfamiliar, and show a preference for the text of a book that was often read out loud before their birth. How can babies know so much so soon? They are well-stocked packages. Just as female infants are born with all the eggs they'll need in later life to make babies of their own, The newborn's brain comes equipped with 100 billion neurons and the ability to learn and reproduce the sounds and tones of any language. In the womb, the sense of hearing is highly developed, which is why babies are born with some auditory neural pathways already well established. After birth, the brain is flooded with unfamiliar sounds as well as sights, smells, flavors, and textures. From this sensory soup, the baby shapes a predictable world. The child could need anything to survive. The ability to identify rain clouds or bicycle horns or the smell of the family horse, the purr of Portuguese, the click of Khoikhoi, or the five tones required to speak Mandarin. The brain says, bring it on, and creates trillions of extra synapses by the time the child is three, twice the number an adult will possess. Scientists call this synaptic blooming, and it makes the brains of young children extremely responsive to new input. For instance, with all those extra synapses, young children can easily absorb more than one language. As learning occurs, some synapses get eliminated or pruned. Which ones? Those that are not used. The synapses that enable a child to click in Khoikhoi will shrivel if he is not raised in Namibia. The synapses that help a child discern the brightness of stars will diminish if she is not born to a seafaring tribe that navigates by the night sky. And if a child hears too few words in his native language, some of the unused synapses, such as those that support grammar and pronunciation, will wither. This doesn't mean it's impossible for the child to eventually master these skills. It means it will require more effort. Ideally, a child should get plenty of grammatically correct, properly pronounced, vocabulary-rich verbal input between birth and age five. The brain of a child who hears a generous variety of words and sounds in a consistent context is etched with a rich map of neural pathways, and as he begins to mimic what he hears, the pathways are embedded more deeply. Numerous studies have documented the effect of the word gap, the difference in social and academic prowess among children who hear a plentiful assortment of words and those who don't. Watching television or playing with educational language enrichment apps does not support language learning in children under the age of two. Just as bodies need nutrients to grow, the brains of babies and young children thrive best in an atmosphere of abundant, human-to-human verbal exchange. Why talking with dad makes babies smarter. A toddler and his dad are ambling along my neighborhood's main street on Sunday morning when the boy sees something he wants. He smiles, releases his father's hand, and runs ahead to a bookstore. He bangs on the glass door with a small fist. Dad. That's right, Jeb. That's the bookstore. It's closed today. Jeb stops smiling and starts pounding. Dad. I know. It's fun in there. That's where we go for story time. Let's look inside. See? No one's there today, but we'll come back again tomorrow when it's open. The settings, posture, pace, social expectations and language of mothers and fathers teach different, equally valuable skills. Mother style promotes social learning and bonding, while fathers provide a bridge to the outside world by using a more adult tone, a different lexicon, and more open-ended dialogue. Studies show that when fathers hold a baby in their lap or wear a versatile carrier, they more frequently choose to face the baby outward towards the passing scene than do mothers who face the baby toward their own body. It's a fitting metaphor for the way time spent with dad broadens and enriches children's experience throughout their lives. Again, in my neighborhood, a dad kneels at eye level next to a 2-year-old in a stroller. They watch as workmen use a jackhammer to break up a driveway across the street. Dirt and chunks of concrete fly. The pair are mesmerized, equally appreciative of the noisy, dusty spectacle. Fathers bring to child rearing a sense of adventure and taste for risk that is often at odds with mothers' natural urge to protect and plan. Dads take kids on buses and trains not only with the goal of reaching a destination, but also to share the thrill of traveling in large vehicles with lots of people. They follow impulses to explore, to seek, to be on the move, and be in the moment even without packing extra binkies, wipes, and snacks. When they encounter a challenge, the child learns how to deal with the unexpected by watching dad. Lynn Vernon Feagans studies the psychology of literacy and early language development at the University of North Carolina. Her work reveals that when fathers use a diverse vocabulary in interactions with their infants, the children have more advanced communication skills at 15 months and more advanced expressive language development at 36 months. Even if mom and dad have equivalent vocabularies, the children learn words more readily if dad has been regularly interacting with them. The researchers believe this might be because mothers generally still tend to spend more time with their children than do fathers. Mom can recite busy penguins in her sleep, so her commentary on the text may become a bit rote. The mother may also anticipate her child's wishes, unintentionally short-circuiting the conversation. If a brief whimper will produce lunch, why bother formulating a sentence? Out of habit, mom may use words she knows the child already understands. When dad isn't as attuned, it's natural for him to use new words, thus expanding the child's vocabulary. The novelty of spending time with dad may also account for baby paying closer attention. It's not that dads are better playmates, just that they are different from mom. The giggles start here. Just as babies welcome your off-key lullaby, they find a well-timed joke endlessly funny. Well-timed means understanding how much sensory input they can tolerate. Your first bits will use physical sensations and sound. By 2 months, your baby will smile back at you and mimic you if you stick out your tongue. But as with all stimulation for baby, there is a fragile boundary between delight and fear. Any rough handling, including tickling, can cause protest or tears, and the same silly snort that causes giggles when delivered gently will be alarming if it gets too loud. Blow a raspberry on the belly of your 4 or 5-month-old, and you can hear his laugh followed by passionate communication with his eyes, facial expression, feet, and legs. Do it again, and now do it again, again. As baby grows into toddlerhood, both physical and verbal antics amuse him. An adult crawls on the floor, barks, sniffs the air, and curls up like the dog, or simply pokes her head from behind the door and says, "Boo!" Hilarious. And now baby starts to try his own material. Mom asks, Where's your nose? And he points to his foot, grinning madly. Will Mom chuckle if he puts a colander on his head like a hat? How about if he pours his milk from the high chair onto the floor? Oops, Mom looks peeved. Maybe she'll get a kick out of seeing the cereal bowl fly across the room. Geez, tough crowd. Some children are naturals. During a diaper change, my friend's 18-month-old son got some poop on his finger. He pointed at his mom and gleefully commanded, "Taste it." One 2-year-old cracks herself up by mispronouncing names. Her brother Jack is Mac and Daddy is Patty. Another tells her mom, "Amy Russell, you're a pretzel." Eventually, many toddlers get cagey. 2-year-old Flora says to her dad, "Knock, knock." "Dad, who's there?" "Flora, tickle." "Dad, tickle who?" "Flora, tickle Chloe," her big sister. All through the very early years, children are deeply appreciative of adults who take the time to clown around, pretend to fall and bump into things, affect cartoon voices and silly walks, or indulge in over-the-top reactions like crying, "Oh no!" when a stuffed bear falls to the carpet. What an easy audience. You get to play on the main stage, kill with your lamest stand-up shtick, and develop the chops to coax a stubborn child to the table. The connection between solid food and speech development. When I asked a friend with decades of experience as a preschool teacher if her students were showing more speech and articulation delays than in the past, she responded with an emphatic yes. She said that people blame electronic gadgets, but don't realize that part of the problem is the popularity of food pouches. Plastic squeeze tubes of pureed fruits and vegetables. The kids come into school sucking on their breakfast and then have another pouch filled with plum puree and quinoa for lunch. They get in a little baby-like trance, and there's definitely less conversation around the table. There's a mechanical aspect to learning to speak that develops in tandem with baby's cognitive readiness. It's nature's way of making sure everything syncs up. The movements of the jaw, tongue, cheeks, mouth, and lips that allow baby to eat solid food are the same ones that facilitate speech. The muscles that allow us to talk are strengthened when we chew and swallow. As baby progresses from rooting for a nipple at birth to more robust sucking to eating her first mushy solids at age 4 to 6 months, she is preparing to utter her first words. Certain speech milestones correlate directly to baby's eating milestones. For example, taking single sips from an open cup, not a sippy cup or bottle, correlates with advanced lip movement sounds such as w, and being able to move food around inside the mouth enables baby to properly enunciate her words. As convenient as food pouches may be, and there's nothing wrong with occasionally using them as snacks, studies of children in daycare centers confirm what my colleague observed. Overuse of the pouches is affecting children's speech development. Food pouches are a sorry substitute for the glorious world of cuisine. As a general guideline, babies older than 1 year should be able to sit in their high chairs and eat what the family is eating with minimal modifications. The family dinner is a classic occasion for building conversational artistry. But mealtime with a toddler and one adult is also filled with opportunity. Here you can identify flavors, textures, and colors, describe why something is yummy or yucky, and experience the seasons through a bowl of fresh strawberries or pumpkin soup. Look who's not talking. The musical quality of parentese may come naturally to everyone, but the amount of time parents spend talking to their babies varies widely. Many parents consider songs, stories, and narration to be less important than keeping their child warm, fed, and well-rested. Sometimes it's not a matter of priorities, but of temperament. Maybe mom is quiet by nature, or dad feels shy about talking out loud to a baby who can only gurgle in response. Other parents, seeing how alert their baby is to facial expressions and how happily she responds to gentle physical play, consider the quality of that interaction both rich and sufficient. Or maybe parents are distracted by a more predictably agreeable or urgently demanding companion, their smartphone. The impulse to respond to a beckoning ping diverts you from your baby's often subtle invitation to engage. Nothing on a screen provides such a personal and fleeting experience. Fleeting because while your child loves your singing and jokes today, she will not feel that way at 14. Limiting your phone use while in the presence of your child is a healthy habit because babies learn language by having people talk to them and by overhearing conversations. For this to work, the child needs to hear both sides of the exchange. When a baby hears one half of a phone conversation, she can't fill in the gestalt. The context, meaning back and forth rhythm of spoken words and pauses that occur while listening. Instead, she hears exclamations, random phrases, partial sentences. Meanwhile, the baby's own attempts to communicate by yelping, pointing, or kicking go unnoticed by the otherwise occupied parent. Observed at a Starbucks in San Francisco, a dad holds a toddler in his arms as they approach the counter. I overhear him say, "Can you do me a favor?" The question strikes me as odd, but polite, sweet, kind of cool. This man is confident that his tiny child can lend him a hand. Next I hear, "Look through the papers on my desk and find the unsigned contract, then scan and send it now." "What?" "Idiot me." He's talking to his office on Bluetooth. Still on the phone, he says, "Hang on a sec, okay?" He speaks to the barista and then resumes his conversation. His daughter is now excited by something she sees outside the window. She points her finger repeatedly and emits a few ooh-oohs. I look outside and see a cable car filled with people hanging onto straps, passing right by us. Dad is still talking into the air. The little girl slumps and goes quiet. I soothe the pain of watching this with a revenge fantasy. Just wait until that SAT verbal prep bill comes in the mail, my friend. I wish that scene were unusual. Nearly every time I'm out in public, I see children trying to get their parents' attention. But when parents are preoccupied on phones, the children quickly give up. Even sadder are the children who take one glance at the parent with the phone and don't even attempt to interrupt. One study found that adult behavior toward children during mealtime changes when phones or tablets are at the table. Caregivers absorbed in devices frequently ignored the child's behavior for a while and then reacted with a scolding tone of voice. gave repeated instructions in a somewhat robotic manner, seemed insensitive to the child's expressed needs, or used physical responses. For example, one female adult kicked a child's foot under the table. Another female caregiver pushed a young boy's hands away when he was trying to repeatedly lift her face up from looking at the tablet screen. The study reminds us that not just parents, but all caretakers owe it to children to use devices judiciously. Talk to your babysitter or nanny about how baby's emotional and language development is delayed when the adults who are caring for them talk on their phones or focus on screens. Emphasize her vital role as your baby's teacher and conversational companion. Children's reactions to phone-using caretakers or parents remind me of the famous still face experiment conducted in 1975 by developmental psychologist Ed Tromick. You can find it on YouTube. It's one of the most powerful and disturbing videos I've seen. The experiment begins with a mother talking to and playing with her infant. Mom is then instructed to turn her head away briefly and turn back with a blank look on her face. The camera stays on the infant's face as his expression changes from a recognition that something is a little off to, "Hey Mom, seriously, what's up with you?" to increasingly intense efforts to re-engage Mom to pure distress. It's painful to watch, and a relief when the mother is encouraged to follow her natural impulse to comfort her child. The toddler at Starbucks who tried to get her distracted father's attention and then slumped in resignation reminded me of the babies in Dr. Tronick's lab. She wasn't frantic or frightened, as the child in the still face experiment was, but her dejection reflected a tragic lesson learned. Transparent delights, or why print beats screen. Babies can be boring and frustrating, toddlers irritating and relentless. The mother of a three-month-old once called me to ask, "Okay, I've been lying on the floor with her for 20 minutes. Now what?" Another mom confessed, "Having a third baby was a huge mistake. I hate him. He doesn't sleep at all during the day, and he's ugly. He looks like an old, bald man, and he cries all the time." "We all want to cry all the time," I replied. "We just learned to control it." "No one told me it would be like this. The girls were much easier." Whether it's your first child or your fifth, the moment will come when you're either delirious from lack of sleep or bored beyond toleration. So why shouldn't you sneak a peek at your phone? Are you supposed to just stare at your baby until the two of you cry or nod off? Not at all. But consider diverting yourself by looking at something that is not on a screen, like a book or magazine. When you do, the focus of your attention is more public, more accessible. Devices demand a different kind of engagement. Their pull on your emotions and cognition is more private, and your vision is tightly focused on a smaller space. Your peripheral awareness diminishes. If you're texting, it's interactive. If you're surfing the web or watching videos, it's moving and changing. The printed page is static. Nothing will change if you look up from it, which means you have more free-floating attention available to your environment. The parent who is reading a book in the park is more likely to notice his child's cry than a parent who is using his phone. There is another more subtle reason to choose print over electronic devices. If your child can see a cover the heft of a book, the way you flip the pages of a magazine. She's absorbing useful information about you and learning more about your world and hers. The toddler can look over